What if I told you that a single, like, dog-eared piece of paper just shoved in the back of some broker's filing cabinet like 15 years ago has the absolute legal power to override a 50-page ironclad will?
Yeah, I mean, drafted by the most expensive estate lawyers in the country.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Today, we are just tearing down the illusion that finance is only about, math and charts.
It honestly sounds like a massive flaw in the legal system when you put it like
Yeah,
that.
totally.
But in the securities industry, it's just standard operating procedure.
Yeah. Before we get to that completely insane reality, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Great.
They've got a full Series 7 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams. And they're weighted exactly like the real thing, which is huge. Check it out at certfuel.com.
It's a phenomenal resource for tackling exactly the kind of regulatory complexity we're about to get into today.
Yeah, so let's get right into it. Usually, when we talk about legal rules and industry regulations, there is this expectation of mechanical precision, right? Like you break a rule, the alarm goes off, you pay a fine.
Sure.
But when you stepped into the world of customer accounts, suddenly, like totally irrational human behavior collides head-on with these rigid regulatory structures.
Yeah, it's the definition of administrative muddy waters, really.
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking at a regulatory landscape that manages the entire life cycle of human wealth.
Wow, yeah.
Every single securities transaction, every massive market-moving event, it all starts with one simple foundational thing, an account.
Right, just getting in the door.
Exactly. And the rules governing those accounts, they're really there for two primary reasons.
Right.
First, to protect the customer from the firm and honestly from themselves.
Right, which we'll see today.
Yeah. And second, to clearly define and limit the registered rep's liability.
Okay, so our mission today, right, it isn't just to memorize a list of dry FINR regulations. We're going to look at the living, breathing life cycle of a customer account.
From birth to death.
Exactly. From the moment it's born at the account opening stage all the way to the ultimate wealth event, which is, well, death.
Yeah.
And to make this stick, because if you are anything like me, standard textbook reading puts you straight to sleep.
Oh, absolutely.
We are going to follow three very specific recurring fictional clients today.
A case study approach is absolutely the best way to retain this for the exam. So who are we working with?
Okay, first we have Cautious Carl.
Okay, cautious Carl.
Carl is he is terrified of risk. He wears a belt and suspenders at the same time.
Right, covering all bases.
Yeah, he wants everything legally locked down, and he is deeply, deeply obsessed with his estate planning.
Got it.
Second, we have Frantic Fiona.
Oh boy.
She is highly impulsive. She day trades options on her phone while like running on the treadmill at 3 in the morning.
That sounds dangerous.
Oh, very. And she is constantly moving money around between banks.
Okay, so she's a handful.
A total handful. And finally, there is Business Bob.
Business Bob.
Yeah, Bob is a serial entrepreneur. He wears a Bluetooth earpiece 24/7, owns 12 different companies, ranging from a tech startup to like a chain of laundromats.
As one does.
Right. And he is always, always trying to bypass paperwork because he is, quote unquote, too busy.
Okay, so that right there is a registered rep's absolute worst nightmare,
Yeah.
all concentrated into one book of business.
Exactly. So let's start at the very beginning. Before Frantic Fiona can start rage buying options at 3 a.m., she has to actually get in the door, right? Let's look at the customer account information rule. What does it actually take to open the front door of a broker-dealer?
Right, so to open an account, the firm fundamentally needs to know who they're dealing with. They need the customer's legal name, their physical residence, and
What?
to be clear here, P.O. boxes do not count.
Wait, really? No P.O. boxes.
No, they need to know where you physically sleep. It has to be a physical address.
Oh, okay. That makes sense for like tracking people down.
Exactly. They also need to know whether you are of legal age, and they need the name of the registered rep who is responsible for the account.
Okay, that seems pretty basic. But the new account form requires a lot more than just a name and an address, right? I mean, I've seen these forms. They're long.
Yeah, it requires a significant amount of probing. The firm needs your social security number, your employment status, your specific investment objectives, your total net worth, and critically, this is big, your liquid net worth.
Hold up. Why do they care about the difference between total net worth and liquid net worth? Like, if Business Bob is worth $10 million because he owns a bunch of real estate, why does the broker-dealer need to know exactly how much cash he has sitting in his checking account?
It all comes down to suitability.
Okay.
If Bob's entire $10 million net worth is tied up in, highly illiquid commercial real estate, and he only has maybe $5,000 in cash in a checking account. A broker cannot ethically or legally recommend that he buy $50,000 worth of speculative tech stocks.
Oh, because he can't actually afford it.
Right. Liquid net worth tells the firm how much money the client can actually afford to lose without, you know, missing a mortgage payment or going bankrupt.
That makes perfect sense. They need to know what you can actually access today, not 10 years from now when you sell a building.
Exactly.
So let's talk about the paperwork itself. When I go down to my local bank to open a basic checking account, I have to sign my name on like 50 different dotted lines. My hand physically cramps up.
Yeah, we've all been there.
So who signs this new account form for a brokerage account? Fiona has to sign it, right?
Okay, so this is a massive trap on the exam. The customer does not sign the new account form.
I'm going to need you to explain that because it sounds completely backwards.
I know.
When I rent a car, I sign. When I get a library card, I sign. How on earth do I open a brokerage account to trade hundreds of thousands of dollars and not sign the foundational document?
It is entirely counterintuitive, which is exactly why they love to test it.
Right.
Under FINRA Rule 4512, the new account form is the firm's internal record of the customer's information. The customer is not legally bound by that specific piece of paper. The only signature required on that form is the accepting principal, so the manager at the branch.
Wait, so the manager signs it, but the client doesn't sign a thing?
Correct. The principal signs it to denote that the firm has, you know, reviewed the client's information, checked them against anti-money laundering databases, and officially accepted them as a client.
Oh, wow. It's like, okay, it's like a bouncer at an exclusive nightclub.
Sure, yeah.
You don't sign the VIP list yourself. The bouncer checks your ID, decides if you meet the dress code, and they check the box to let you in. You're just the guest.
That's a great way to think about it.
The bouncer is the one actually taking responsibility for letting you inside the club.
That is the perfect analogy. The accepting principal is the bouncer putting their license on the line to say, we accept this customer. Now, to be clear, if Fiona later wants to trade on margin or trade options, she will absolutely have to sign separate legally binding margin and options agreements.
Because that's added risk.
Right. But for the basic cash account opening, she doesn't sign a thing.
That is wild. Yeah. Does the customer at least get to see what the bouncer wrote down? Like, what if the rep just entered Fiona's liquid net worth as $1 million just to justify pitching her riskier trades?
So the regulatory framework anticipates that exact scenario.
Good.
The firm must send the customer a physical or digital copy of that account record within 30 days of opening the account.
Okay, so she gets to check the math.
Right, and they have to send it again every 36 months after that.
Just to confirm, like, hey, is this still accurate?
Exactly. And if Fiona calls up and says, actually, you know, I got a new job and my investment objectives changed from aggressive growth to income, that amendment triggers a fresh 30-day clock for the firm to send her the updated copy.
Okay, I love that. So we have the door open. Let's talk about a relatively new regulation, the Trusted Contact Person, or TCP. Let's say Cautious Carl is sitting across from his broker, setting up his new account.
So the TCP rules, they were designed specifically to combat the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults, particularly the elderly.
Oh, like scams and stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, yeah.
When opening an account, firms have to make a reasonable effort to obtain the name and contact information of a trusted contact person who is at least 18 years old.
Okay, listeners, stop and think about this for a second. Does Cautious Carl have to provide a TCP to get his account opened? Take a beat.
No.
He does not.
No, he doesn't. It is completely optional for the customer to actually provide a name. But, and here's where the exam will try to catch you.
Lay it on us.
Even if Cautious Carl firmly refuses to provide a TCP, the broker-dealer must still provide him with the written TCP disclosure at the time of account opening.
Wait, so the firm has to say, we strongly suggest you do this, and here is a legal document explaining why, even as Carl is literally shaking his head no across the desk.
Yes. They have to explain in writing what a TCP is and the specific circumstances under which the firm would contact them. The firm has to officially document that they made the reasonable effort.
Okay, let's play this out. Let's say Carl eventually relents. He's like, fine, whatever, and names his niece as his TCP.
Okay.
A few months later, his niece calls the broker and says, Uncle Carl is in the hospital. It's terrible. Please sell his shares of Apple to cover his medical bills. Can she do that?
Absolutely not. A trusted contact person has zero trading authority.
Zero.
Zero. They cannot execute trades, they cannot move money out of the account, and they cannot even change the account address.
Then what is the point of even having them on file if they can't help in an emergency?
Well, they are strictly a communication emergency contact. The firm can reach out to the niece to confirm Carl's current contact info if he, you know, stops answering his phone for weeks.
Oh, I see.
Or to check on his health status, or, and this is the big one, if they suspect he's being scammed by a third party and they need to place a temporary hold on disbursements.
So they're a sounding board.
Exactly. They're a sounding board for the firm's compliance department. They're not a proxy for the client.
Okay, got it. So the bouncer's signature is on the form. The TCP disclosure is handled. Now, Business Bob wants to actually fund his account so he can start trading his laundromat money.
Right.
He is driving. He calls his rep and says, hey, just pull 10 grand from my checking account. You guys already have the routing number for my old setup. Can the rep just hit a button and pull the funds?
No. A firm cannot pull funds from a customer's external bank account without express written authorization.
Really? Even if they have the info?
Even then. Okay. A verbal, trust me, go ahead from Bob over the phone is a massive regulatory violation.
But Bob hates paperwork. He is going to throw an absolute fit if you email him a DocuSign. Is there any way around a formal authorization document?
There is, and it's a classic exam trap.
Oh, I love these.
If Bob simply writes a physical check from his bank account, signs it, and hands it to the rep or mails it in, his signature on that negotiable instrument serves as the written authorization.
Oh.
No extra forms are needed for a simple check deposit.
So the check itself is the permission slip.
Correct. But if Bob wants to set up a recurring ACH pull every month, you know, automatically, that requires a separate written authorization document.
Right.
And the record-keeping rule here is that the firm must keep that authorization on file for 3 years after the authorization expires or is revoked.
3 years. Okay. So let's move from the front door into the room itself. The accounts are open and funded, but what kind of vehicle are these clients actually driving? Because the account type fundamentally dictates the rules of the road.
Yeah, let's start with the baseline, which is the cash account.
Okay.
In a cash account, there is no borrowing, no leverage, and no margin.
Keep it simple.
Right. When you buy a security, you must pay for it in full by the settlement date, which under current rules is generally T plus one. So trade date plus one business day.
Okay. Let's bring in frantic Fiona to test this rule.
I knew she was coming back.
Fiona has a standard cash account, zero margin. She wakes up at 9 a.m., sees a tech stock plunging, and buys $10,000 worth of it.
Okay.
The problem is, she currently has $0 in cash sitting in her brokerage account.
That's a problem.
But she gets lucky. At 2 p.m., the stock bounces hard. She sells that exact same position for $12,000. She thinks she is a financial genius.
Of course she does.
She plans to just use the 12 grand she made from the afternoon sale to cover the 10 grand purchase she made that morning and just pocket the $2,000 profit. Clean and simple, right?
Fiona just committed a major federal violation known as free riding.
Okay, break down why this is illegal for me. If I buy a car in the morning for 10 grand and sell it for a profit in the afternoon, nobody arrests me. Why is it illegal in a brokerage account?
Because of Regulation T, which is the Federal Reserve Board's rule governing the extension of credit in the securities industry. Mm-hmm. Remember what we just said about T plus one. Trades execute immediately on the trade date, but the actual exchange of cash and securities doesn't happen until the settlement date, T plus one.
So there is a 24-hour gap where the broker-dealer is essentially floating the trade for her.
Precisely. Fiona exploited that settlement gap. She bought a security and sold it without ever actually putting up her own capital to pay for the initial purchase.
Ah.
She took a free ride on the broker-dealer's capital and the market's momentum.
Okay, direct question to the listener. Stop and think. What is Fiona's punishment for free riding? Is her account closed forever? Are the police called? Take a beat.
Yeah.
No. The penalty is a 90-day freeze.
And we really need to be crystal clear about what the term freeze means in this context, because the exam will absolutely test the nuance here.
How so?
A 90-day freeze does not mean her account is locked and she is banned from trading.
Wait, really? She can still buy and sell?
Yes. But for the next 90 days, she loses the privilege of the settlement gap. The freeze means she must have sufficient settled cash sitting in the account up front before she's allowed to enter any purchase order.
So she gets put in the financial penalty box.
Pretty much.
It becomes cash on the barrel head only. You want to buy 10 grand of stock. You better have 10 grand sitting there clearing dust before you even click the buy button.
Exactly. It completely removes her ability to exploit the timing mechanics.
But what if Fiona actually wants to day trade legally? Like, she wants to use leverage, buy and sell multiple times a day on purpose. Let's talk about the pattern day trader rules.
Okay, so if a customer is going to day trade, which is defined as buying and selling the same security on the same day in a margin account, they need to be aware of the pattern day trader, or PDT classification.
PDT, got it.
You are officially designated as a pattern day trader if you execute four or more day trades within 5 business days, provided those day trades represent more than 6% of your total trades in that margin account during that 5-day period.
Okay, so 4 trades in 5 days, greater than 6%. What actually happens when she hits that threshold?
2 things happen immediately. First, she must maintain a minimum equity of $25,000 in the account at all times.
25 grand, okay.
Second, in exchange for meeting that minimum, the firm grants her day trading buying power of 4 times her maintenance margin excess, which is significantly higher than the standard 2 times leverage you get in a normal margin account.
Okay, wait, I need to interrupt you right there.
Sure.
I follow financial news pretty closely. Didn't FANRA just recently repeal the pattern day trader margin rules? Like, I thought they moved the whole industry to a real-time intraday margin standard. Why are we still learning the 4 and 5 rule and the $25,000 minimum if it was repealed?
That is an excellent catch, and it highlights a critical exam survival tactic.
Okay, lay it on me.
Yes. FINRA did repeal its specific version of the rule to modernize their margin calculations. However, the CBO, the Chicago Board Options Exchange, still actively maintains the exact same legacy framework for its trading permit holders.
Wait, really?
Yes. The 4-day trades in 5 days, the 6% threshold, the 25 grand minimum equity, and the 4x buying power. It's all still there.
So because CBO kept it, it still exists in the regulatory ether.
Exactly. It is still current law under CBO, and much more importantly for our listeners, it is still explicitly listed on the Series 7 exam content outline.
Wow.
Do not get tricked by the news cycle.
Yeah.
Trust the exam outline. The exam will absolutely test those specific numbers.
That is a lifesaver. Never argue with the test.
Exactly.
So that covers the mechanical rules for a client who decides to day trade. But what if a broker-dealer actively wants people to day trade? Let's say Business Bob decides to open a new brokerage firm, and his marketing strategy is running these like late night television ads featuring a guy on a yacht screaming, "Trade options every morning and retire by noon."
Right. So if a broker dealer actively promotes a day trading strategy to non-institutional customers, whether that's through aggressive advertising, holding seminars, or, you know, targeted website content, they immediately trigger 2 massive mandated compliance requirements before they can open a single account.
They basically paint a giant target on their own back.
They really do.
What is the first requirement?
A specialized risk disclosure statement. They must deliver this document to the customer prior to opening the account.
So before anything else.
Right. And it is not a standard boilerplate warning. It explicitly tells the customer that they should be prepared to lose 100% of their money.
Yikes.
That they are competing with highly capitalized professionals. And it specifically warns that an investment of less than $50,000 will significantly impair their ability to profit due to costs and fees.
Wait, $50,000? You just said a minute ago that the minimum equity to be a pattern day trader was $25,000. Why does the disclosure say 50?
Another classic exam trap.
They love these numbers.
You have to keep the purposes of these numbers separate in your mind. $25,000 is the hard regulatory minimum equity requirement to simply keep your account active for day trading.
Okay.
$50,000 is a warning figure that must be printed in the text of the risk disclosure document to basically scare off undercapitalized retail investors. They are 2 different numbers for 2 entirely different regulatory purposes.
Got it. 25 to play, 50 is the warning label. That's a great way to remember it. So the firm hands over the scary disclosure. What is the second requirement?
The firm must choose a path for every new client, option A or option B.
Okay.
Option A means the firm formally approves the account as appropriate for day trading. To do this, a principal has to review the customer's income, their net worth, and critically, they must exclude the value of the customer's primary residence from that net worth calculation.
Oh, so no counting the house.
Right. And they have to look at their previous trading experience.
Right.
The principal must put in writing why day trading is suitable for this specific person.
That sounds like a ton of liability for the firm. What is option B?
Option B is the opt-out.
Mm-hmm.
If the customer insists they aren't going to day trade, even though they walked into a firm that promotes it, the firm must obtain a written agreement from the customer explicitly stating they do not intend to use the account for day trading.
Let's test this with cautious Carl.
Perfect.
Carl sees the yacht commercial, but he obviously doesn't want to day trade. He's Carl. He goes to the firm and signs option B. The document says, I, cautious Carl, will not day trade. I just want to buy blue chip dividend stocks and hold them for a decade.
Okay, classic Carl.
The firm says great, and they open the account. But 6 months later, Carl gets bored. He downloads the firm's mobile app, drinks 3 energy drinks, and suddenly executes 15 day trades in a single week. What happened?
Well, the firm has a major compliance problem now. The moment their surveillance systems flag that Carl is day trading, despite his written agreement, the firm must pivot to option A. They are legally required to formally approve his account as appropriate for day trading as soon as practicable, and no later than 10 days after learning of the activity.
10 business days.
Exam trap. 10 calendar days.
Wait, why calendar days? Usually, everything in finance runs on business days.
Because market risk does not take the weekend off when assessing suitability.
Oh, that makes sense.
If a client is engaging in highly risky behavior they explicitly promise not to do, the regulators want the firm resolving that suitability question immediately, regardless of bank holidays or weekends. If the firm cannot determine that day trading is appropriate for Carl within those 10 calendar days, they must shut down his day trading capabilities entirely.
Calendar days. Listeners, write that down. Let's shift away from retail day trading and look at how the real heavyweights operate. Institutions. The outline mentions DVP and RVP accounts. What are these?
So DVP stands for delivery versus payment, and RVP is receive versus payment. These account structures are used almost exclusively by large institutional investors, like pension funds, mutual funds, or major insurance companies.
But why do they need a special account type? Like, why can't a pension fund just use a normal cash account like Carl?
It comes down to scale and counterparty risk. Imagine a pension fund is buying $50 million worth of treasury bonds.
Okay, big money.
In a normal retail account, you might send the cash to your broker-dealer on Monday, but the broker might not actually deliver the bonds into your account until Tuesday afternoon.
Right, the settlement gap we talked about.
Exactly. For a retail investor, that gap is annoying. For an institution moving $50 million, that gap creates what we call principal risk.
Principal risk meaning the risk that the broker-dealer goes completely bankrupt on Monday night while holding $50 million of the pension fund's cash before actually delivering the bonds.
Exactly. Institutions flat out refuse to take on that risk. So a DVP account requires simultaneous lockstep execution. The securities are only delivered if the payment is simultaneously released.
Boom. Instantaneous.
Furthermore, the assets do not actually sit at the broker-dealer. The broker-dealer merely executes the trade. The actual cash and securities are custodied at a third-party institution, usually a massive custodian bank. The trades settle on a trade-by-trade basis directly with that bank.
So if I want to pull up a DVP account statement on the broker-dealer's computer screen, it might just look completely empty.
It would show the execution history, sure, but the actual custody balances wouldn't be there because the broker doesn't actually hold the assets.
Got it. Okay, let's talk about how the broker gets paid, because there is a major suitability trap here regarding fee-based versus commission-based accounts.
Oh, absolutely. So in a traditional commission-based account, the customer pays a fee every single time a trade is executed.
Pay per action.
Right. In a fee-based account, the customer pays a flat ongoing percentage of their assets under management, or AUM, every year. And they pay that regardless of whether they execute 0 trades or 1,000 trades.
See, a fee-based account sounds like the premium fiduciary option to me. There's no nickel and diming per trade. The broker's interests are aligned with the client's account growth. So as a rep, I should definitely put cautious Carl to a fee-based account to do the right thing, right?
If you do that, you are likely violating regulation best interest, or Reg BI, and committing a practice known as reverse churning.
Reverse churning. Explain that.
Think about Carl's behavior. We know he is a strict buy and hold investor. He might buy 3 stable stocks a year and hold them for a decade.
Yeah, he barely trades.
So if you put him in a commission account, he pays maybe $30 a year in trading fees.
Tinies.
But if you put his $500,000 portfolio into a fee-based account charging, say, 1.5% annually, he is suddenly paying $7,500 every single year for almost 0 trading activity.
Oh my gosh. So the exam trap is thinking that fee-based is just automatically the ethical or superior choice.
Precisely. Fee-based accounts are generally appropriate for active traders or clients receiving comprehensive ongoing financial planning who would otherwise be eaten alive by individual commissions.
Right.
Commission-based accounts are generally far more suitable for buy-and-hold investors like Carl. You must match the fee structure to the customer's actual transactional behavior.
Okay, we have built the room. We know the account types and how they are built. Now we need to figure out who is actually on the title. Registration types. Because how an account is legally registered dictates what happens during your life, and more importantly, it dictates exactly what happens to your money when you die. Let's start with joint accounts.
Okay, so joint accounts are shared by two or more adult individuals. But the absolute critical distinction the exam demands you understand is the difference between JTWROS and TAKE.
Let's spell those out. JTWROS is joint tenants with rights of survivorship.
Correct.
And TAKE is tenants in common. Let's set up a scenario to break this down. Against all odds, frantic Fiona and business Bob decide to go into business together and open a joint trading account.
A match made in heaven.
Right. They each put in $50,000, so the account has $100,000. Bob is walking down the street, simultaneously yelling into his Bluetooth earpiece and texting on his other phone.
Classic Bob.
He steps off the curb and gets hit by a bus. Fatal. What happens to the $100,000 in that account?
The outcome depends entirely on those acronyms.
Okay, break it down.
If they open the account as JTWROS, right of survivorship, the mechanics are instantaneous. The moment Bob dies, Fiona automatically inherits his share. She now owns the entire $100,000.
Wow, just like that.
Just like that. The assets bypass the probate court process completely. Bob's family, his heirs, and his creditors get absolutely nothing from that specific account.
The survivor takes all. Brutal for Bob's family. What if they had checked the other box and opened it as TITIN, tenants in common?
Okay, so if the account is T-TIKE, the automatic survivorship feature does not exist. Bob's share of the account belongs to him, even in death. So Fiona retains her $50,000, but Bob's half gets frozen. It becomes part of his messy, complicated corporate estate. It has to slowly grind through the probate court process before it can be distributed to his heirs.
Listeners, if you are reading a question on the Series 7 and you see the words probate or estate mentioned in relation to a joint account, those are glaring neon signs pointing directly to tenants in common.
Absolutely. And there is one more structural difference to keep in mind.
What's that?
JTWROS always requires equal undivided ownership. If there are two people, it's 50-50. If there are four, it's 25% each. But TIAC allows for unequal percentages based on contribution.
Oh, so Bob could legally own 80% of the account while Fiona only owns 20%.
Exactly.
What about married couples? I always hear about community property.
Community property is a legal framework for married couples, but it's only available in about 9 states, mostly in the West and Southwest. The massive advantage here, and what the exam focuses on, is the tax treatment known as the step-up in basis.
Okay, I love this one. Let's explain the math on this because I call this the step-up cheat code. It is a massive tax loophole. Let's say a married couple buys a stock for $20 a share. Over 30 years, the stock skyrockets. It is now worth $80 a share. Then, tragically, one spouse passes away.
Right. Under a standard JTWROS account, only the deceased spouse's half of the asset gets a step up to the current market value of $80.
Okay.
The surviving spouse's half retains the original cost basis of $20.
Yeah.
So if the grieving survivor needs cash and wants to sell the entire position immediately, they're still going to owe a significant chunk of capital gains tax on the growth of their own half.
But if they lived in a community property state and registered it that way?
The math changes entirely. If registered as community property, both halves of the asset receive a full 100% step up in basis to $80 at the exact time of the first spouse's death.
So the surviving spouse could sell the entire portfolio the very next day, take all the cash, and owe literally zero capital gains tax to the IRS.
Exactly. The IRS effectively resets the tax clock on the entire asset, treating it as if they bought it for $80 the day before they sold it. It is an incredibly powerful estate planning tool.
That is wild. Okay, let's pivot to Business Bob's actual businesses. He wants to open an account for one of his companies.
So business accounts have very strict, specific authorization requirements because the firm needs to know who legally speaks for the entity.
Right.
If Bob operates as a sole proprietorship, meaning it's just Bob doing business as Bob's landscaping the business, and Bob are legally the exact same entity, he is personally liable for everything, and he just uses his own social security number or an EIN to open the account.
So it is basically just an individual retail account wearing a fake mustache?
Yes, pretty much.
Yeah. What if he goes into business with Fiona and forms a partnership?
For a partnership, the broker-dealer must obtain a copy of the formal partnership agreement. This legal document explicitly dictates who has trading authority.
Generally speaking, that is going to be the general partner, right? Because they are the ones taking on the unlimited personal liability for the business. Limited partners are just silent investors putting up capital.
Generally, yes. Limited partners usually cannot execute trades. But here's the exam trap. You must read the document. If the partnership agreement explicitly states in writing that a specific limited partner does have trading authority, the broker-dealer must honor that document. The agreement is the absolute law of the land for that account.
Okay, what if Bob has a full-blown C corporation for his tech startup? Can he just call up the broker and say, hey, I'm the founder and CEO, execute this options trade for the corporate treasury?
No. A corporate account requires a corporate resolution.
A resolution?
Yes. This is a formal, legally binding board document, often stamped with a physical corporate seal, explicitly naming the specific individuals authorized to execute trades on the corporation's behalf.
So, but can't just wing it?
No. A verbal, trust me, I own the place, from Bob is meaningless. No resolution, no trades.
Okay, so we have the accounts open, we know who owns them, we know how they are taxed. But life changes. People move furniture around. Let's look at account changes and transfers. Say, frantic Fiona gets married, calms down a little bit, and wants to change her last name on her brokerage account to match her new legal name.
Okay.
Can her rep just log into the CRM system, backspace her old name, and type in the new one?
Absolutely not. Only a qualified registered principal can approve an account name or designation change.
Ah, the bouncer returns.
The bouncer is back. The principal must be personally informed of the essential facts surrounding the change, and they must approve it in writing. And this is critical for the exam. If there is a pending trade in the account, that written principal approval must happen before the trade execution.
Wait, why? Why does it matter if there's a pending trade?
To prevent fraud and money laundering, the regulators do not want a scenario where someone executes a massive, risky trade under a fake or altered name and then tries to fix the paperwork later to cover their tracks. Cool. The approval must precede the action.
Got it. Now let's talk about moving money between firms. Business Bob gets furious at his current broker-dealer because they keep demanding an updated corporate resolution every time he wants to trade.
Right, because they have to.
Exactly. He decides to move his entire multi-million dollar account to a brand new firm across town. How does that actual transfer mechanism work?
The industry uses the AC system, the Automated Customer Account Transfer System.
Okay, direct question to the listener. Stop what you are doing. Who initiates the AC key transfer? Is it the old firm Bob is leaving or the new firm Bob is going to? Take a beat.
Yeah.
As the receiving firm.
Correct. Bob walks into the new firm, fills out a transfer instruction form or a TIF, and the new firm reaches out through the system to forcefully pull the assets from the old firm.
Let me guess why the rule is written that way. Because if the delivering firm, the old firm, had to initiate it, they would suddenly, mysteriously lose the paperwork for 3 months while their retention team called Bob every single day begging him to stay.
You nailed it. The regulatory framework assumes the old firm has a massive financial incentive to drag their feet and keep the assets under management. So the system empowers the new firm to act as the aggressor.
I love that. What is the timeline for this? I call this the 1-3 rule.
Okay, so when the old firm, the delivering firm, receives the AC CAT request, they have exactly one business day to either validate the transfer instructions or take formal exception to them.
One day.
Once the instructions are validated, they have exactly 3 business days to physically complete the transfer of the assets. So 1 day to validate plus 3 days to complete equals a minimum timeline of 4 business days total.
But let's say the old firm is really desperate. Bob is a huge client. Can they take exception and delay the validation just to buy themselves another week to talk him out of it?
Absolutely not. This is a very common exam trap. Customer retention, or we want to talk to him first, is not a valid exception.
Nice try, old firm.
Right. The rule provides the delivering firm with a very specific closed list of technical reasons they can reject the transfer.
Give me an example of a valid reason to reject it.
A mismatch in the social security number between the two firms. A missing signature on the transfer instruction form. An invalid or closed account number.
Oh, so just paperwork stuff.
Exactly. They are purely administrative paperwork errors. They cannot dispute the transfer simply because they are losing the revenue. If the paperwork is clean, they have to let the money go.
Fascinating. So we have covered opening the account, the account types, who legally owns it, and moving it between firms. Now we arrive at the final chapter of the account life cycle, the ultimate wealth event, death.
Yeah, it is the one single event that is absolute mathematically guaranteed to happen to every single natural person in your book of business. Grim but true. So a registered rep is drinking their morning coffee, reading the Sunday paper, and they see an obituary for cautious Carl. Or maybe Carl's wife calls the branch office in tears and says Carl passed away in his sleep last night. What is the very first thing the rep must do?
Immediate, decisive action is required here. The moment the rep learns of the death, and by the way, even if it is from an informal source like a newspaper obituary or a phone call, they do not need to wait for a death certificate to take this first step. They must do three things instantly.
Okay, what are they?
First, cancel all open orders. Second, freeze the account so no assets or funds can leave. And third, notify a principal.
Let's break down the why there. Why do they have to cancel the open orders? What if Carl had a limit order to buy a stock at a great price?
Because the legal entity that authorized that order, Cautious Carl, no longer exists.
Oh, right.
The authority to execute that trade died with him. The estate, which is the new legal owner of the assets, has not authorized the trade. Executing it would be acting without authorization. So the account is frozen, open orders are canceled. Carl's wife is on the phone. She says, Carl always told me to sell his Apple stock immediately if he died to pay for the funeral. Please execute that trade. Can the rep do it?
No. The rep must be empathetic, obviously, but they must politely explain that the account is legally frozen. They cannot take any trading instructions from anyone, not a spouse, not a child, until they receive the proper formal legal documentation.
Which is what exactly?
Usually that means an official death certificate and letters testamentary from the probate court officially naming the executor of the estate.
Okay, this brings us back to the registration types we talked about earlier. How does the registration dictate what happens to the frozen assets?
Well, if Carl's account was registered as JTWROS with his wife, the process is incredibly smooth. She provides the death certificate, and the firm simply re-registers the entire account into her individual name.
So no probate court.
No letters testamentary are needed because the asset legally bypasses probate entirely.
But if it was an individual account just in Carl's name?
Then it is headed for probate court. The firm will freeze it, wait for the court to appoint an executor, receive the letters testamentary, and then re-register the account into the name of Carl's estate.
All right, I want to set the stage for what we teased at the very beginning of this deep dive. We are about to witness the ultimate heavyweight battle in estate planning.
This is where theory meets reality in a very harsh way.
The last will and testament versus the TOD form, transfer on death. Here's the scenario, and I want you to walk me through the legal mechanics.
Okay, ready.
Cautious Carl spends $50,000 hiring the best estate lawyers in his state. He spends weeks drafting a 50-page ironclad will. In this document, he explicitly, unambiguously states that his entire fortune, every dime in his brokerage account, is to be left to his beloved local animal shelter foundation.
Very noble of Carl.
Right. The will is signed, it is notarized, it is witnessed by a priest, a judge, and the mayor. It is a bulletproof legal document.
Okay, I see where this is going.
But 15 years ago, back when Carl first opened his brokerage account, the rep handed him a simple one-page administrative form called a TOD transfer on death. At the time, Carl was casually dating frantic Fiona.
No.
He quickly scribbled Fiona's name on the line as a 100% beneficiary, signed it, and handed it back to the rep. He completely forgot about it. He never updated it. He never mentioned it to his lawyers. So, Carl dies. The animal shelter shows up at the broker-dealer with a 50-page will and an army of lawyers. Fiona shows up with a photocopy of the 15-year-old TOD form. Who gets the money?
Frantic Fiona gets every single penny of the account.
That is completely insane to me. How is that possible?
It is basic contract law. A transfer on death designation is a direct, legally binding contract between the account owner and the broker-dealer.
Okay.
The contract states, upon my death, transfer these assets to this specific person. That contractual mechanism passes the assets outside of the probate process entirely.
But the will is 50 pages long and notarized.
It doesn't matter. A will is a set of instructions for the probate court to distribute assets that are inside a person's estate. But because the TOD executes immediately upon death, the brokerage account never actually enters the estate.
Mm.
By the time the probate court opens the will, the brokerage account is already legally gone. It belongs to Fiona. A TOD supersedes a will, it supersedes a trust, it supersedes a prenuptial agreement. If the will and the TOD conflict, the TOD wins every single time.
So the animal shelter's high-priced lawyers can't do anything to stop the broker from handing her the check?
No. The firm simply looks at the TOD form on file, sees Fiona's name, verifies the death certificate, and hands her the money. The only thing that can stop a broker-dealer from executing a TOD is a direct injunction or order from a judge.
Wow.
The estate lawyers can try to sue Fiona after she gets the money, arguing intent. But as far as the broker-dealer is concerned, their liability ends by following the TOD contract.
I have an exam trap question regarding this. While Carl was still alive, let's say Fiona was snooping through his mail and found out she was named on the TOD form. Could she call the broker and demand to see the account statements to see how much money she was eventually going to get?
Absolutely not. TOD beneficiaries have zero rights, zero standing, and zero access to information while the account owner is alive.
None.
Carl could have changed the beneficiary form the next day. He could have spent all the money. He could have closed the account entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Fiona has no legal claim to anything until the exact moment Carl's heart stops beating.
The absolute power of a single sheet of paper. Unbelievable. We have covered an incredible amount of ground today. We're going to close this out with our rapid-fire recap to lock in the material for the exam. I'm going to throw out a concept, and I want the crisp, testable takeaway for the listener. Ready?
I am ready. Let's lock it in.
Who signs the new account form?
The accepting principal at the firm, never the customer. The bouncer signs the list.
How long is the free writing freeze, and what does it actually mean for the client?
It is a 90-day freeze. It means the customer can still trade, but they lose the settlement privilege. They must have the fully settled cash up front in the account before placing a purchase order.
What is the specific timeline for an ASIC transfer?
The 1-3 rule. 1 business day for the delivering firm to validate, 3 business days to complete the transfer, 4 days total minimum. And remember, it is always initiated by the receiving firm.
In a joint account, what is the critical difference at the time of death between JTWROS and TIC?
JTWROS skips probate entirely. The surviving owner gets the assets automatically. TIC goes through the sluggish probate court to the deceased's estate. Look for the words probate or estate as your clues for TIC.
Does a TOD designation beat a properly executed last will and testament?
Every single time, contract law beats probate law.
Boom! That is exactly what you need to know to crush function 2 on the Series 7. Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final thought based on what we just discussed.
Yeah, I want you to think about the immense, almost terrifying power of that simple TOD document. A single piece of administrative paper sitting in a file cabinet at a broker-dealer for 15 years completely overrides a lifetime of expensive estate planning, lawyers, and probate courts.
It's crazy.
It really is. It proves that in the world of finance, the simplest, most mundane administrative forms often wield the most absolute, unshakable power over human wealth. Do not underestimate the paperwork. Read every line.
A chilling but necessary reminder. Remember that when you step into the world of customer accounts, you aren't just pushing paper around a desk. You're navigating the rigid legal architecture of people's lives. Best of luck studying for your Series 7 exam. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.